This episode is brought to you by Seems Easy Record Sleeve Repair Strips. If you collect used records, you need some Seems Easy strips handy for record sleeve repair. They're super easy to use and repair those seam splits to make them like new.
Ask your record store for Seems Easy or go to SeemsEasy.com.
Seems Easy with two Z's. SeemsEasy.com. And now, on with the show. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 368 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week, we have an incredible guest, Mr. Scott Kirkland of The Crystal Method, who is not only celebrating the release of the new Crystal Method LP, The Trip Out, but also taking a trip to Australia and New Zealand starting December 7th in Auckland, then on to Sydney, Newstead, Adelaide, Melbourne, and Perth. Tour dates and ticket links are up at thecrystalmethod.com. And I got to say, these shows are going to be amazing. The Crystal Method is a great party soundtrack. And after the last few years of what everyone's been through, I think we're all ready for it. The Crystal Method touring Australia and New Zealand this December 2022. Now today, Scott and I talk all about vinyl, the early records of the Crystal Method's career, the rare and collectible records of their catalog, the recent box set making remixes working with Tool, plus we talk quite a bit about synthesis because, well, full disclosure, I'm a bit of a synth nerd too. We cover quite a bit with Scott today, who's an absolute gentleman and enjoys talking all sorts of various electronic nerdery, music, and more. And for those of you just finding out about the Vinyl Guide podcast, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here. And could I strongly suggest that you subscribe or follow the Vinyl Guide podcast in your podcast app, especially if you like the Crystal Method or vinyl records or both, because we've got hundreds of other episodes that I think you'll enjoy, including episode 366 with Gerald Casale of Devo, talking history of the band, Saturday Night Live, early records, and more. Episode 364 with Royksopp, talking Banksy records, profound mysteries, and more. That's episode 364, The Vinyl Guide. Episode 357 with Amon Tobin. Episode 348 with Cut Chemist. We've got literally hundreds more. Subscribe to The Vinyl Guide in your podcast app to hear all these episodes and enjoy the fun. All right, without further delay, let's get into our conversation with Scott Kirkland of The Crystal Method.
Hello.
Mr. Scott.
Is this Nate?
This is. How are you?
Nice to meet you.
You were expecting an Australian accent, eh?
Yeah, well, you know, you never know. I mean, you just you could just be really playing up the American accent there. But where are you at?
I'm in Sydney. I've been here. I've lived here 20 years.
So where did you live before?
In the Bay Area, actually. San Jose, Santa Cruz.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Was it a woman or a job that took you down
here? you know it well. Yeah, I chased a woman down here.
Hey, that's a good place to chase a woman, I tell you. There's worse places to find love. Absolutely. I mean, I absolutely love Australia and really, really looking forward to coming back down there.
Oh, we're looking forward to having you here. By the way, the woman is upstairs now. It's all worked out. 20 years later,
Good.
Yes.
Good. That's fantastic.
Anyway, we're looking forward to seeing you guys as well. So, this tour has been a while in the making. New album, The Trip Out. I guess you've had all this pent-up angst from the pandemic that is now just exploding onto our shores. Is that fair?
Well, this original run of shows was to happen in your winter of 2020, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then it got pushed back to summer of 2020. And then again to summer of 2021. And then we finally were able to put this together for the summer of 2022. So I've been cautiously optimistic, every time that we've had to push it back that we were going to be able to make it happen, super enthusiastic and excited that we're finally going to make it happen. So,
yeah. Oh, it's going to be a hell of a party this summer here because we're now entering summer in Australia. This summer, there's so many bands and there's so much. The pubs are open. People are out. The weather's going to be great. So you're coming at a fantastic time, not only just in the year, but in terms of history
This is the first summer we're kind of being uncaged after the pandemic.
Oh, wow. It's a great recipe for a good time. I don't know if I could be more excited, but you're definitely throwing some more logs on the fire for me. So I appreciate that.
All good. So Scott, I've always wanted to have you on the show. A couple of things. Number one, now, not only do we talk about records and music and things like that, I'm also a synth nerd.
Oh,
so
nice.
I'm keen to kind of jump into a few different rabbit holes with you here.
Sure.
So first off, are you a vinyl collector? Do you have a record collection?
Well, behind this couch is my little DJ turntable setup. I have one of my 1200s over there simply only because I had another piece of gear on the end here. But yeah, I have. So this the stand that it's on is full with vinyl. I've got a whole set of vinyl over there. I have vinyl in the hallways. I have vinyl at my house. I'm stubbornly holding on to so many albums that, you know, when I go through them, I'm like, this promo of a breakbeat song from, you know, 2001, what am I going to do with this? And then I look at that and I find another one and I just keep finding them. And I keep, you know, when I have the time, I pull out and drop the needle and go, oh yeah, you know, remember this track. And it's a great nostalgic journey. And of course I am really proud that we were able to, you can see it over my shoulder there, to do a vinyl release for this album. And also for my last album, The Trip Home. So I believe in vinyl, always have. I wish that I would have taken better care of some of the stuff that I was, first pressings of, you know, Beastie Boys, you know, Radiohead albums that I'm playing, you know, in a club. I'm just taking them out, like, you know, when desperate to find the next one. So, but they're astonishingly resilient. You know, if it's just muck, then you can get that muck off, and they can clean up pretty well sometimes. So, I'm a big believer in vinyl. Absolutely.
Now, the new album obviously is available on vinyl. Some of the other recordings that you've had as well, The Trip Home, definitely. For the rest of the Crystal Method catalog, is it available on vinyl, or is it in a situation, a legal situation where you can press at will?
Well, actually, the first two albums, Vegas and Tweekend, were part of a separate record deal that with Universal, so they control those. Somebody in the bean counting world realized that original pressings of Vegas were going for $200-$300 a pop on eBay, and somebody said, hey, we should reproduce this. So they did, and I actually have some not for sale versions that I'm going to sneak into my carry-on, so I'm trying to bring some stuff down from that as much as I can to sell it to some of the shows. But some of the other albums, they're all out of print. We did do a box set a few years back, and that had all of the albums that I did with Ken, going from the first to the last one, the self-titled album, with some rarities and things like that. So those first two albums are the ones that we don't control, but we were able to get the okay for them to repress them. So I'm contemplating, you know, doing something similar to that going forward, maybe on the, I think, 30th anniversary of the band, which is, you know, a few years away. That would be something that would be a lot of fun to put out. And I think something that people would like to pick up. So.
Oh, absolutely. So vinyl will be on the merch table in these Australian stores, not just the new album, but possibly others.
As much as United allows me to carry in my bags down there. I don't know what the import laws are. I'm not sure how that all works. We'll have to figure that out. But yeah, I know shipping to Australia is insane. But that's my goal, to bring as much as I can down there.
So let's go back a ways in your early life. How did records shape you as a kid? Do you recall any pivotal albums that kind of helped form the musician that you are?
Without a doubt, my mom and dad were huge music fans. They were really young when I was born. So, my dad was 17, my mom was 16 when I was born. So, I mean, they were massive fans of very diverse styles of music. My mom loved disco and things of that nature, of that era, pop music, Michael Jackson and those different things. My dad loved, you know, progressive rock, and he had, you know, Pink Floyd albums and Outlaw albums. And so he would listen to music a lot in the house. He had a great turntable, really great set of speakers, really proud of his setup. And I remember when we would have little parties, Christmas parties or whatever, I would be in charge of the music because I was like, I'll do the music. You know, I was, you know, early on, I felt this deep connection to, you know, playing something and having people react to it. I just remember playing Christmas tunes and you know, having my grandmother's, you know, foot, you know, go to the beat, or like somebody walk in and do this kind of stuff, you know, react to it. And it's something that, you know, I felt a connection to from a very early age. And the first vinyl, I think that, I don't know if I owned it or if I owned it or my, if I asked them to buy it for me, but the John Williams score for Star Wars was something that, because I was an only child. And so I had a lot of, and a latchkey kid. So I had a lot of time on my own. So I would, you know, drop that needle on that album and get all my toys out and reenact with my action figures and just, you know, I immerse myself in the memories of the movie, the visuals, and then just to enjoying the warmth and depth of recordings of that nature. And then of course I started buying my own albums. A lot of it was heavy metal stuff, you know, and really excited about going to record stores. I remember one time I was so enthusiastic about going to a record store that, and my mom, they were really busy, my mom and dad. So one day I just was determined, I'm going to get up and I'm going to ride my bike all the way across town to this heavy metal store that I've been hearing a lot about. And I did that without having anything to eat. It was like 6 miles uphill, across town on my bike, got in there, got all my records, all the ones I was really eager to buy. Rat's first EP, like I had the Wasp album, some Metallica thing. I've got all this stuff. I'm walking up the counter and all of a sudden I start feeling lightheaded and I like pass out. And I hit my head on the pane glass window and dropped to the floor because I was low in blood sugar. And they called an ambulance and they whisked me out of there. And I'm like, but I didn't, my records, I didn't get to buy my album. I've always loved music. I don't remember a time when I didn't love music and appreciate, you know, the experience. And I think that's that experience. I love the randomness of Spotify and some of these other sites where you can listen to anything at any time in any order, but the magic of an artist's sequencing and the segues and the consistency of like something just going on its own for 15 to 20, 30 minutes is something that that isn't greatly appreciated as much as it used to be. But again, now that vinyl is being purchased, my daughter loves vinyl. So, I mean, she's 14 and she's got a bunch of her own albums that she's been buying and playing on her own. So that's very wonderful to have her make that same connection with it. So it's been something that I've, you know, again, I don't have a memory of me not loving and enjoying music in some form or another.
Yeah, yeah. For really the past couple decades, with music primarily being enjoyed in headphones, it's no longer, it kind of worked its way out of being a communal experience.
Yeah. Like
probably when you bought those heavy metal records, you'd probably listen to some of them with your friends and you'd have a conversation and you'd say, oh, this track is great. This track, not so great. Why is it? And it inspires you creatively, especially
absolutely.
As a musician.
Yeah, absolutely. I would also air drum. I would, because I always wanted to play drums. My mom never was not a big fan of me pounding on things during the day and night. And so she encouraged me to take guitar lessons, which I did. But, you know, I had one drumstick and a stick from the backyard. And so, and I think it's what really helped me with my sense of timing and rhythm going forward, because I was able to key into, you know, the different elements in the song, which I didn't understand at the time, that I, you know, I just was someone that could just hear all the different parts and the different layers of it and sitting in my living room and listening to music. I know my kids love music and they listen to music. You know, like you said, my son kind of, he listens to stuff on tiny headphones, which, you know, he's happy with. But my daughter likes bigger, higher quality Sonics. But they both are so used to hearing it in that limited frequency range. And I think that a lot of music, especially pop music, is catered towards what frequencies work and how they master or how they produce. And so it's been something that, you know, everybody has been evolving with, but for a lot of us audiophiles, we love, you know, the warmth of a nice sound system and being able to hear it in full bloom and in an environment that lives and breathes with the tune when you're listening to it.
Yeah, for instance, for the latest albums, well, the Trip Home was 2018, Trip Out was this year. When it comes to mastering those, do you have a version for digital formats and a version for and a different master for vinyl? How do you ride that balance?
Yeah. So for the past two albums, and historically, like Vegas was cut to, they have a separate room where they somebody else that's really in tune with cuts the vinyl, the master, and then you go forward. Today, with the different ways that we have to master for digital, you know, everybody is pushing the limits of loudness. And although I was really wary of doing that on the Trip Home, because I really wanted it to feel organic and I didn't want to be the loudest record, just to be the loudest record. Yeah. I wanted it to be something that you can enjoy in any environment, and you weren't just, captured by the whims of the moment. But I did do a different sort of mastering for this, for the Trip Out, where I did more of because the music was also different as well. So I had a separate mastering for that. And then my mastering engineer, he went in and did a separate run for vinyl. So you bring the levels down, you give more, it has a little bit more headroom. You know, also you have to, you know, narrow the bottom end so that the groove can be cut better. And nowadays, I think that they've come up with a digital algorithm to take digital recordings and then create an acetate or a file that then could be cut to vinyl with the kind of precision and that would be necessary for it to live in that environment as well as the digital environment. And also, you know, the quality of the vinyl and where it's manufactured, you got to take all that in consideration. And then you go through all the, you know, you open up, you know, one of every 20 when they get here, and I, you know, critical listening and make sure that there isn't, you know, certain things, because it's still in an analog world. They're still cutting those things. They're coming off the press. They're going into the sleeves. And, you know, every once in a while, you know, something does occur. And I did have a situation where a few of the run for this latest album did have something in there that I found that they were able to correct on other pressings. But that's part of the analog world. It's part of what you, I enjoy about the imperfections of analog.
You got to love the imperfections. That's kind of part of the adventure. Yeah. So it sounds like you are really hands-on when it comes to the vinyl, the product, the manufacturing. Are you making decisions about like colors of vinyl and the whole experience, that sort of thing?
Yeah, because I collected most of the vinyl I collected was pre-coloring, and you know, I though I do have some like picture disc and different things like that. I find that we did do a color for retail. So I have their direct to consumer. I did a bunch of regular blacks, and then there were a bunch that were done of color ones for retail. But yeah, I think it's something that, you know, in the environment where your one seller is looking for something unique than the other seller, you know, you get into that different variations of pressings. But as far as like what the end result of what you get, I'm definitely in with the mastering engineer, going back and forth, listening to all of the different versions, critically, you know, coming up with the sequence, and then, you know, and then it goes forward, and then I trust the people that know what they're doing when it comes to how to get it to vinyl and sound the best that it can sound.
So young Scott is buying his Motley Crue records, and
Motley Crue, but you knew that I like Motley Crue at some point. Yes.
Well, look, you're saying Rat, you're saying heavy metal. It's
absolutely.
Yeah. And so how do you start to transition from guitar to keyboard or to the, to kind of the big beats? What was that transition?
It was Black Celebration from Depeche Mode. A friend of mine played it to me in class one day on a Walkman, because I was really skeptical. You know, people are people and just can't get enough. And it's, you know, it's a little fluffy for me. And like, it didn't, you know, wasn't, I, you know, I had this, you know, my idea was power and girth and like, you know, an edge. And I just remember listening, I was just getting chills even thinking about it, listening to Black Celebration and hearing a pop, pop, and all this different sound effects, and sonically it sounded so cinematic and dark, and I just was like, oh man, this is fucking amazing. I mean, I remember that night, we got to go to Tower Records. I got to get this mom. I got to get this album. I got to go to Tower Records. That was the gateway drug, if you will, into electronic music and getting into New Order and Cabaret Voltaire or Nights of Reb or, going down that journey into new music. And then a couple of friends of mine that were really into, The Cure and Echo and the Bunnymen and Church and all these different bands. So I still had the other side of me that listened to Metallica, Master of Puppets, but that worked well in my mind with Black Celebration and some of the other things of that genre, because it was darker and edgier and it, and I loved the sonics of it. And I remember not touching my guitar for a while after hearing that, that album and getting, wanting to get a synth and got a synth and then got a four track and a drum machine. And, I started, just taking that journey into production that leaned, I still was playing guitar in some of my early things that I was working on, but it supplemented with this other side, because again, it was like, well, I don't have a bass player, but I got a bass sound on this keyboard that I can use on the four track and create a bass line in the background. So yep. it was a good blend of the two worlds.
What was that first keyboard you got?
The very first one I got was a CZ-101, the small little Casio mini keyboard. And it was really, it's a digital, but it horn sound, piano sound, nothing real fluffy and cutting edge. But I did one of the sounds I was able to create with it was the big low end 808 sound that is prominent throughout Vegas, including on Keep Hope Alive and High Roller. And that was all just this, wow, I got this huge, massive 808 bass sound out of the small little digital keyboard. Then I got a D50 from Roland, and then a sampler, the EMAX 2 sampler, and then off and running. EMAX 1 keyboard, then EMAX 2 rack mount, and then it just, I was... like some guys were, drooling over Playboy, centerfolds. I was drooling over old synth magazines. Look at this. Look at this. It's an EML. Look at this thing. Look at how many fucking knobs are on this thing. And then we just started to be able to find, afford stuff and find stuff. And there was a really great, like a paper that came out every week called The Recycler, where people would put things for sale, and we'd go down to the recycler office when they released the first pressing on Wednesday at like 6 a.m. and we'd go through it, and I'm like, there's a Jupiter 6 in Monrovia. Let's get in the car. You're trying to figure out when you're going to call them. They're like, it's 7. I'm sorry, it's so early, but they're like, yeah, I guess, so we got some good stuff through that. And then of course later on we just started to pick up stuff. And I mean, I have my Roland rack here with a Juno 60 and the Jupiter 6, the Jupiter 8, the TR 707, the 606. I never got a 303, but I have a, Monopoly, ARP Odyssey, ARP 2600 here, a lot of Nords, some other Moog stuff, Korg, MS-20, various different things in all over the rooms in here. A lot of pedals, a lot of guitar pedals, because we love distortion and warming things up and experimenting with sonics of oversaturating stuff and that became our sound.
I grew up in San Jose, as I mentioned earlier, and that was where Sequential Circuits was.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in Sequentials that work for Sequential Circuits, when it shut down, they didn't get paid, so they just took gear home. Yeah. So we would find Prophet Fives at garage sales.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But back then it was kind of like $75. I'm not going to pay $75 for this.
Yeah. No. I know. It's crazy. Like, it's crazy that what some of the stuff was going for at the time. But, it was I'm thankful for what we picked up, because it really helped our creative process. And you mentioned Sequential Circuits. I mean, these very untimely passing of Dave Smith. Last year, I mean, truly a remarkable human being who I was able to meet a couple times and hang out with, and was invited down to DSI and their headquarters in San Francisco, and one time I was opening for Tool, and he came out to the, I invited him to come out to the show, and just truly one of the coolest, most naturally kind persons I've ever met, and really, really bummed to hear. I mean, I've got shot glasses that he gave me from NAMM events with, you know, different pieces of gear on them, and he loved Tequila as much as I did, and just real bummer, real bummer to have him leave us too soon. So,
but what a visionary.
Wow, absolutely amazing.
Absolutely. And did you ever meet Bob Moog?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up.
Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside,
so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new.
Turn a $5 used record into a $50 functioning collectible.
Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. Did you ever meet Bob Moog?
I see your shirt there. It was later on in years. He was at a NAMM thing. It wasn't the same sort of connection that, but because, you know, he was a little bit older and a little frailer, and but he was the genius of that company and that man, and what they've gone, what they've become, and the incredible company, it's employee owned. They really take care of their people. They're really creative. They really are innovative, and they're headquartered out of Asheville, North Carolina, which is a really beautiful little town and on the East Coast. So, yeah, big fans of their world as well.
So I could absolutely go in this synthesis rabbit hole with you. I used to synthesize for a living. I used to do presets in a lot of I'd work for in Sonic, Korg.
Oh, nice!
I had one of the.
Yeah, we had the ESQ-1 was Ken was a Mirage guy, and then the EPS 1200.
I had a prototype Kurzweil K2000 when they were coming out, and they used to ship me the prototypes. I'd synthesize like 100 or 150 patches, send them back, and then they would pay me with a keyboard once the production line was up and going.
Oh, interesting.
And by then I was totally sick of the keyboard. But yeah, I also noticed that you are a big fan, of the Roland Boutique series, which is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. My favorite is the SEO2, the collaboration they did with the Studio Electronics. They all have, you know, characteristics of the original, you know, the ease of operation, the flexibility of having something that you can hook up into your computer and record all the different moves and that. Yeah, I've been, you know, a big fan of a lot of the stuff that Roland, I did a NAMM event for them a few years back with their rack mounted modular series that they were coming out with. So yeah, I'm looking around the room at the different things. I have a 909, I have a CR78, Never got an 808. They were always just a little bit too out of our price range.
Do you have to go through all your old vintage gear and like recap them and that sort of thing? I mean, yeah, they're getting 40 years old plus, yeah.
Yeah. That's something that I have a couple pieces. I have a list that continues to grow that I'm going to just take to a local guy that specializes. There's a few of them in town, but there's one that in particular that I'm going to deal with that will hopefully be able to bring, you know, I have an Oscar that has been fucked for like 10 years now. And you know, like you said, the chips start to fail, leaky battery or some other thing that, you know, you can't tell that's going on under the surface. So, and in ARP Odyssey, one of the oscillators is out on it, or maybe it's a filter. I'm not sure, but yeah, I've got a bunch of things that are in need of a special attention and some and proper TLC. So yeah, I gotta get that stuff fixed. But yeah, you know, you just never know. You plug something in and you don't know if it's gonna be the same as it was when last you played it.
Yeah,
and that's the nature of it all.
So when the Crystal Method was starting to, you know, rise and become into prominence, that was around the same time that file sharing and Napster came in.
That was after the second album. Yeah, right around the second album. Yeah.
Yeah. What was your reaction to Napster? What did you think initially, anyway?
Well, in regards to our music, since we didn't have a lot of airplay, radio airplay, and understanding that it was a groundswell of initially thought process was that it was a groundswell of people that, you know, just wanted music and just wanted to find music. And it became like, even for me, when I was discovered it on my own, the things I was interested in were bootlegs of a early AC/DC recording that was done, you know, I remember one of the first things one of the things that I was like, wow, this exists, is this early version of Back in Black that was with Bon Scott. You know,
I've never heard that.
Finding things like that were fascinating to me. Live versions of things. It had a real swap meet sort of vibe to it. You know, like, you know, you know, I don't think an artist would be begrudged going down to a, you know, searching the thousands and thousands of swap meets that took place every week where people were taking their music and then reselling it or selling it, you know, or redistributing it. And it had that kind of vibe. But then of course, it took on a whole different vibe when the labels who didn't understand how things were going to move forward and change with, you know, digital and the computer was becoming like the central thing in people's homes. It was no longer the turntable or the cassette player or the stereo system. So with the malaise of the big companies not understanding and not caring about what was going to be taking place and how things were going to evolve, and, you know, still expecting the consumer to buy an album for basically one or two songs. I mean, that was never our goal was always to, you know, all killer, no filler, but there were, you know, a lot of bloated projects and, you know, a lot of reaping of profits. And so initially I thought I was fascinated with it, and I thought it was great for the community, because again, people would be able to find our music that maybe didn't have a record store or someplace or a radio station in town that was playing us. Things got a little crazy when I still to this day we get we asked about tracks that were mislabeled when they were uploaded into Napster or some of the other, you know, sites. You know, like somebody would that thought we did a remix of something and it lived like that. There was the track in Blade, the big New Order remix of Confusion, the real big techno-y one that was played in the Blood Rave in one of the big scenes that was uploaded and mislabeled as the Crystal Method because we had a song in one of the Blade movies or something like that, or they just thought. And so still to this day, people will ask us to play that, you know, play your song from Blood Rave. I'm like, it's not our track, but I, you know, I'll see what I can do. But, you know, and then it became a battle between the big business and you know, feisty consumer. And then you know, Steve Jobs comes in and you know, introduces this whole other, you know, thing. And things started to evolve differently. But again, you know, I our sales, along with so many others, dipped down and evaporated because, again, and it was easier to go on your computer and find it than try to go to a record store and find it if the record store wasn't carrying it. So
that must be really interesting, especially with all the remixes that you do and the labeling and things like that. Yeah, I can see where I never thought about that, how all those errors could occur. In those remixes, how does that conversation start? Do you start thinking, okay, I'd like to revisit something like the Doors Roadhouse Blues? Does the Doors team in the state reach out and say, hey, we'd like to kind of have a different view on this song? How does a remix start typically?
Yeah, they're all different. They've been mostly organic. You know, the artist, you know, going back to some of our really early mixes where we were part of a smaller label that was releasing artists, and they, like, say, for instance, with like Kyoki, with this Caterpillar remix that we did, you know, it was like, here's $500, you know, here's the parts. Do you want to do this remix? And, you know, we were very, you know, hungry and wanting to showcase our style. And so we did a lot of things in the early days where it was you know, just take what you get and make the most of it. And then someone like Moby calls and says, through management, hey, Moby wants you to do a remix of something. Garbage remix was one where we had a friend of a friend was, I think it's a lot of them came from like, oh, this Crystal Method would be cool to do a remix. And they liked our music. And then once they came to us, we were like, oh, we'd love to do a remix of, you know, I think I'm Paranoid from Garbage, or Boom from POD was another one. We did a Linkin Park remix because they appreciated our music. And then, say, as you go forward and, you know, you have some success with those, some of those were really synced a lot, you know, especially like something like the Boom one. Of course, that was already a big song from POD that was being synced a lot because it just has all the boom, you know, trailer. Right. That's right, set for the trailer. And our remix slotted in there and did really well. But with the Doors, so we had this sort of catalog of things that we had done. So we'd shown that we could take, you know, an artist and not completely disembowel it and reshape it. Like, we've always thought, like, you know, when somebody asks us to do a remix, they're not wanting us to, like, take 5% of the song and make, you know, do a completely new track around it. They want to still to get the essence of the song, but with our stylings and our flavors and our, you know, our production techniques and different things that we do. So with the Doors, I think it was our manager was friends with their manager, and somebody was going in and redoing some of the catalog stuff. And we got a call to, you know, if we wanted to do a Doors track. And immediately we thought, Break On Through would be the one that would make sense, but that was already taken by another artist. And so, you know, Roadhouse Blues was right there, and we were like, okay, well, the tempo's right. It's a real shuffly track. We figured we could do something with it. It was fascinating getting the separate parts. So, you know, nowadays stems come in and they're like, you know, you got the hi-hat on the separate track, you got the kick and all the snares and clean bass and dirty bass and, you know, mm-hmm. five different guitar tracks and three different vocal tracks, background vocals, all that. They only had four track or something. I think it was, so you'd have the guitar going and then all of a sudden a tambourine would come in, and then, you know, then an organ would come in, and then, you know, they were just mm-hmm. piecemealing however they could at the time over what they had, which is real, I mean, you know, fascinating to understand, you know, what their limitations were when it came to recording. But, you know, having an appreciation for the original track is very important, and having an understanding of what to do with it once you get it. And that was one that they loved. I remember the great joy of meeting the few of the surviving members that
Densmore and Robbie Krieger.
Yeah, Densmore and Robbie Krieger. And I just remember I have this wonderful memory of sitting. We were at a party. I think it was something to do with the release, and they were really kind and generous in telling you know, Ken and I how much they appreciate the track and how much they love the remix. And then one of them said out of the side of their mouth, like, much better than the Break On Through remix that we got from the and I just remember, like, you know, like, when I remember I threw out, hey, listen, if you want us to do do something with that, just let us know. And they did send us the parts, and it's a tricky one, and I still have the parts. We got sidetracked many times over on that one, but it is tricky because it, you know, there's not a lot of there. It's a fantastic track and you know, an iconic track, and I think one of the biggest ones in their catalog. But but as far as doing some sort of thing that had the structure of a club track, it was a bit challenging. And I think the reason why they didn't appreciate the remix that was done, well, A, I don't want to talk badly of who did it, but it was also, there was a little hands-off approach to it. But I think that also, it was such a big track, it's really difficult to figure out a way to do it justice, if you will.
When you go back to some of the older records in the catalog, do you find yourself, are there any samples that you needed to go back and clean up or clear or anything like that? That back in the day, there was always, it was a little bit more liberal than it is today.
It definitely was. I mean, the first album, we didn't really, I don't think we cleared any of the samples. We didn't have a lot of them. We did. We cleared for Busy Child. We cleared the Eric B. and Rakim sample from Know the Ledge. And then we tried to find the other one, but we couldn't find out who the other sample was. And then there were some other little pieces in there. But when we knew, when we knew that it was prominent and we knew that it would be discovered, we definitely cleared it. There are a couple things that didn't get cleared, you know, the Richard Pryor sample, and I think there's a Bill Cosby sample in there. And then going into the next album, Tweekend, we definitely, everything was much more buttoned up for that. And although I think there are some little things that we were like, nobody's ever going to, hear that. I mean, it's like, you're just, you know, it's like something you're just rolling in the background to enhance your own understanding of what the rhythm or the structure of the section is. And, you know, it's be hard pressed for anybody over the last 20 years to find an album, especially in electronic, that where they didn't sample something. I mean, Daft Punk, of course, they're the kings of it and reimagining samples. But it's something that we, I don't know if, how would that work now. I mean, so Keep Hope Alive, that was public domain with the speech, and also the NASA samples in High Roller. Those were all public domain. So, you know, it's something that we did start to pay attention to a lot more when we moved forward.
Yeah. I also understand you had a collaboration with Justin of Tool, in a project called Bandwidth.
Yes.
Are there any recordings available of that project, or will there be?
Well, Justin is one of my best mates, and he and I actually met on the Big Day Out tour that back in 2009, I believe it was, mm-hmm. and became fast friends and got into to. Did our best to make the most of our time down there when we were down there, which it was. Awesome, amazing time. We got a lot of things that we've started. He did contribute a bass line to a song on called Cabin Pressure on the Trip Home. There were a couple projects that we were working on, including this really great heavy track that didn't necessarily fit into the trip out. He actually just texted me 2 days ago about a track that I sent him that he played over. The Bandwidth project did the Foles remix. It was just credited to him because at the time they didn't have the way Spotify, you list things, I didn't have my own I didn't have my own name up there. So as an artist, that was something, you know, I didn't really think about. So it wasn't credited, although it says Bandwidth, some other thing about Justin Chancellor on there. But and we did a Crystal Castles remix that I don't think was ever released. And we've done a couple other things that, we did a Pucifer mix. I think that came out as a Bandwidth. You know, so it's like being in the room when he's playing bass, it's like, you know, seeing a chef from a different planet make food that you don't, you know the instrument, but you just understand how they're able to, the way the mind works and the way the fingers move and the way that manipulate the bass and the way that he thinks I just love him. I love the band. Getting an opportunity to tour with them for 6 or 7 dates back in 2017 was truly like one of the most, bizarre, you know, like rock band, like dream camps for scenarios for me. And but we still have plans to do some things. And he's got another project called Empty Void with a friend of his from Peter that I think that they're just released or about to release their second album. So yeah, hopefully some more stuff will be coming from us collectively as Bandwidth or collaboration between myself and his project or him and the Crystal Method.
Oh man, Scott, thank you so much for joining us here on the show and going through all the history of the Crystal Method and answering some of the factoids and remix talk and even synth nerdery. That is very much appreciated. And yes, look us up when you get to Sydney. I too had a rack mount Emacs 2, and I remember connecting it to my SideQuest zip drive.
Oh yeah, yeah, yes. It wasn't a zip. The zip drive was separate. No, wait. SideQuest, was that the name of the zip? No,
The manufacturer was SideQuest. I think they call them zip drives, the 100 megabyte ones. Then there was the gigabyte ones. I forgot what they called. It was
great. Okay. Yeah, yeah. We had the one that I had connected to. That was a rack mount. It was like a bigger piece of tape. And it was like a
jazz drive.
Jazz drive was another one from that company, but there was another one that was like a spinning thing of tape, and it was like 44 megs. But anyways, yes, I still my Emacs 2 sits hovering over me on a shelf over here. The SideQuest, the different, I have all of that stuff. The zip drives, the jazz drives, all of it. Still holding on to it, like for whatever reason, not sure why. We've come a long way in data storage. That's for damn sure.
Absolutely. Now I've got a USB key here that probably holds as powerful as my whole studio was in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And that would have cost, I mean, if you were to show up and walk into a room with that in 1997, that would be worth $10,000 as far as the megabyte-gigabyte ratio of what they were charging for. I mean, for stuff back in those days, it was iOmega. That's what it was. iOmega. Ah, yes, iOmega. iOmega. But the other one is, I think, the company that made the one that I was, that I, SideQuest was another company that did storage. iOmega. Yeah, iOmega. The zip and the jazz. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh boy, you just cleared out a whole bunch of cobwebs in a second. So Scott, we can't wait to see you down here in Australia, all you Aussies. December 9th in Sydney, December 10th in Brisbane, December 14th in Adelaide, the 16th in Melbourne, and 17th in Perth. All this before the Christmas holidays. The weather's getting warm. It's time to party. What better soundtrack to have than the Crystal Method? So make sure you go to thecrystalmethod.com for tickets or metropolistouring.com. Check out the new album, The Trip Out. It's available now. It's on all streaming services, but there are vinyl copies available. And if you show up at the shows, then you could probably grab one from the merch booth. Scott, thank you so much for spending your time with us, and I look forward to a future nerd session with you.
Yeah, I absolutely look forward to it as well. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. And I can't wait to get down there.
Excellent. Bring your board shorts.
Absolutely.
Okay. Oh, man. I've always
always enjoyed the music of the Crystal Method, and knowing that Scott is such a nice guy there makes it all the better. So make sure you check him out live. You can go to thecrystalmethod.com. There's all the dates around New Zealand and Australia here in December. Also check out the new album, The Trip Out, available on vinyl. And if you can get to one of those shows, grab some of those other vinyl pressings he has. Those aren't easy to get, so make sure you see him live and hit up the merch table while you're there. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter. Leave us a positive review on iTunes. That's always huge. Give us, I think, what is it, 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 stars. Say something nice. Let the newbies know all about The Vinyl Guide. And that is always appreciated. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.